Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Monday, the 29th of January, freshly back from Washington, D.C., and the Saturday protest. I got to tell you the story about that right after the first break. And really, an extraordinary learning experience that I had that I want to share with you. But first, Ilan Giorno is with us. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute, a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, AynRand.org, their website. Ayn Rand, of course, the thinker, the writer, the author who wrote Atlas Shrugged and other both fiction and nonfiction pieces that led to objectivism. Alan Greenspan was inducted into her organization back in the 1950s in her apartment in New York City. And the objectivists have heavily influenced the thinking of the libertarians, who I refer to as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And for that matter, the modern Republican Party, much of the highly conservative, the Grover Norquist branch of the Republican Party. I realize, Ilan Giorno, you guys are not that. You are far more objectivist than all that, but a lot of it really began with you, would you not say?
Well, in some terms, yes. I think Ayn Rand's influence on the intellectual life of America is considerable, but if only she had been a bigger influence on the conservatives, then the country would not be in such a bad state as it is today.
Yeah, because in fact, many of the conservatives these days have gone, in a way that Ayn Rand would not have agreed with. And that I don't agree with either, although I also generally don't agree with objectivism. So here we are. I have multiple viewpoints. But the Ayn Rand Institute just issued a news release suggesting that because Iran may be providing material support for the Iraqis and perhaps for the insurgents in Iraq, although we have these two news stories, one that in 2003 Iran tried to through Flint Leverett, who was at that time Middle East the senior director of the Middle East Initiative of the National Security Council, tried to communicate with the U.S. government and said that they would stop support for anti-Israeli terrorist organizations and address concerns about their weapons programs. The Bush administration said, no, we're not going to talk to you. And now Iran and Baghdad are expanding their outlets. Iran is opening a branch bank in the heart of Baghdad, in the heart of Iraq. And at the same time, Bush says, if it's an Iranian, kill it. What's the deal here?
Well, I have to say, I disagree with what the Bush administration is trying to do now, and I agree with what they did in 2003. Justice demands that we treat Iran differently. The Iranians are growing in their influence in the region, and they're trying to grab a hold of Iraq and bring it into their realm. And
if that's the case, how can you agree with what Bush did in 2003 by invading Iraq? Because Iraq was a largely Shiite country that was run by a Sunni dictator and stable.
I was referring to the news story you said where Iran approached the U.S. and the U.S. rebutted.
Oh, I see. I see. I'm sorry.
No, I definitely don't support the Iraq war from the beginning or now. I think it was the wrong war. The war should have been targeted at Iran, and as we've talked about before, and I've been on your show. The issue is that what the Bush administration is trying to do now is to mount these tiny pinpricks against Iran for these acts of war in Iraq, where it's supporting insurgents and growing its influence. And I mean, most of the people in the Iraqi parliament who are Shiites are beholden to Iranian funds and Iranian influence.
Sure.
So Iran is trying to grab the levers of power. Excuse me.
One could argue that they already have. But you know, isn't the solution for us to simply say, okay, guys, we're out of here, and bring in the Arab League and bring in some serious diplomacy and let the people who live in that region sort out that region rather than us, you know, throwing more troops in? And you're suggesting we should start bombing Tehran next week.
I think there are two issues. One is the question remains, I think Iraq is in an insoluble situation, but there's one responsibility left to us, which is to retaliate against the insurgents who have killed Americans. That is the minimum we should be doing.
Well, hang on just a second.
The second issue is, what do we do with Iran? And I think we should just pull them out and go into Tehran and take down that regime, as we should have done years ago before they became so bold and so advanced in their nuclear program.
Okay, so if Mexico were to invade the United States, and you and I were to say, okay, that's it. We don't want, you know, let's say Mexico looks at the United States and says, you know, the majority of Americans don't want Bush as president. He wasn't actually elected as president in 2000. He was appointed by the Supreme Court. There are questions about the Ohio election. It looks like it was stolen. The guy isn't a legitimate leader. We're going to go in and we're going to take down his government. If Mexico invaded the United States to do that, I would be out in the streets with a rifle trying to repel them, and I'm guessing you would be too. And if Canada then said to you and I, hey, we'll help you throw Mexico out, wouldn't we want to take their help?
I think this is a false analogy. I think
Why?
The analogy has to be that
we invaded Iran for no good reason. They did not attack us. There was no provocation.
Yeah, but I mean, on the one hand, saying that they should go to Iran for help does not legitimate what they're doing. I mean, it does not legitimate the U.S. invasion either.
They're trying to throw out what they view as invaders. What's illegitimate about that?
Well,
I mean, I agree. I am horrified that our soldiers are being killed. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But you know, it was George Bush's decision to invade a country that, you know, I mean, this is the first time since Germany invaded Poland in 1934 that a major power has invaded another major country without any provocation. It's illegal. This was a war crime that George W. Bush committed.
Well, I'll tell you, the bigger crime is what he's not done, which is make America more secure, which the Iraq War certainly could not have done. It was not even as you probably know, it was not a source of Islamist terrorism or sponsorship. I mean, it was a trivial sponsor.
No, I absolutely agree, but invading Iran is going to, I mean,
no, but see, but that's the problem with Iraq. Iraq, I agree with you, is a complete mess. It was an illegitimate operation. But the tragedy, apart from the troops who are dying needlessly, the tragedy is that Iraq has completely discredited a legitimate means of defending ourselves, which is war, preemptive war. And that is what we should be doing and defending as a legitimate application of our right to self-defense.
War is one dimension of politics, Ilan Chornow. It's the ultimate, it's the last straw of politics. It's the thing that you do when all else fails in politics.
What do you think should come before that? I mean, you suppose
negotiations.
We should invite Tehran to the discussion table?
Diplomacy, absolutely. Absolutely. There are many forces
who are arming themselves to kill us and have already killed hundreds of Americans, not just in Iraq, but over the years in Lebanon and all around the world.
We did the same thing with the Soviet Union for 50 years, and we avoided a war. You talk with people. You talk with your enemies. You engage in diplomacy before you go to war. War should be the thing of last resort, not first resort.
Well, I would challenge that analogy to the Soviet Union. I think the Soviet Union was able to sustain itself for so long because we were engaging it in talks and providing it with aid. I mean,
no,
we,
nonsense.
We would have fallen
the Soviet
longer.
Union was able to keep itself alive as long as it did because it was largely sucking out the resources of its client states. I mean, we can go back to Yalta and probably agree, you know, that Roosevelt shouldn't have been as friendly as he was with Stalin. But that's neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is, once the Soviet Union started pointing nuclear weapons at us, did we push the button and take them out? No, we sat down and talked with them. We connected a hotline between the White House and the Kremlin. We should be talking to Iran. In 2003, Iran said, we'd like to talk to you. We said, no. And so here we find ourselves in this situation. This is the absolute failure of diplomacy and politics. And war is going to make it worse.
I disagree with that entirely. I think the only solution with Iran, and the one that's overdue, is military confrontation, because that is the language they understand. You cannot treat them with civility when what they're trying to do is overthrow our civilization.
They're not trying to overthrow our civilization. They're trying to tell us to leave them alone.
I think that requires evading Iran's larger goals and its widespread support for anti-American and anti-Western terrorists. And its support for the jihad, the worldwide movement of Islamists to invoke...
Al-Qaeda, which attacked us on 9/11, was a Sunni organization, not a Shia organization. It not only had nothing to do with Iran, but Osama bin Laden was an enemy of Iran.
Iran is very generous to both Shiite and Sunni groups, as you well know, in the case of Hamas, for example. So I don't think you can carve it up that way. And so with...
But certainly Iran, not Al-Qaeda. You're not trying to suggest that Iran ever supported Al-Qaeda.
Well, there are Al-Qaeda people hiding out in Iran right now.
Yeah, well, I suspect that if the Iranians were to track them down, they wouldn't be there very long.
Anyhow, no, they are under the auspices of the Iranian government.
Ilan Jorno, the website Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. Ilan, good talking with you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for coming on the program. 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Show, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
Hey, you don't want to be listening to those neocons. And welcome back. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Iran sent messages to the United States. This is the Media Matters excerpt, by the way, this is from the Washington Post. This is actually from the Washington Post. Iran sent messages to the United States in May of 2003 through back channels seeking negotiation. Brookings Institution senior fellow Flint Leverett, who from 2002 to 2003 served as the senior director for the Middle East Initiative at the National Security Council, wrote in the New York Times on January 24th, that the Bush administration, quote, has turned away from every opportunity to put relations with Iran on a more positive trajectory, end quote. He laid out three examples. He said, in the spring of 2003, shortly before I left the government, the Iranian Foreign Ministry sent Washington a detailed proposal for comprehensive negotiations to resolve bilateral differences. The document acknowledged that Iran would have to address concerns about its weapons programs and its support for anti-Israeli terrorist organizations. That would be Hezbollah and Hamas. It was presented as having support from all the major players in Iran's power structure, including the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The conversation I had shortly after leaving the government with a senior conservative Iranian official strongly suggested that this was the case. Unfortunately, the administration's response was to complain that the Swiss diplomats who passed the document from Tehran to Washington were out of line. Kill the messenger. Just like with Joe Wilson. Don't like the message? Kill the messenger. Or his wife, in the case of Joe Wilson. So what are they going to do? Now there's some indication that the real plan for Iran is the Khuzestan Gambit, as the military planners call it. There's this part of Iran, it's a relatively small region of Iran, actually, called Khuzestan, that has about 90% of all of that country's oil. And if you can just grab hold of that little piece of Iran, you got the whole thing. As described by a leading military website, the province is, quote, a one large piece of flat Iranian territory to the west of the Zagros Mountains. American heavy forces could swiftly occupy Khuzestan, and in doing so, seize control of most of Iran's oil resources and major portions of the country's water supply and electrical generating capacity. Because Khuzestan is a relatively small area, the U.S. would be able to take it without many boots on the ground, therefore a new draft won't be needed. I mean, this is how these guys are thinking, right? I mean, this is how these guys are thinking. The Khuzestan Gambit isn't even a new idea. This is what Saddam Hussein was trying to do in the Iran-Iraq War, as he was trying to get to that area. In the meantime, today's New York Times, just as we learned that Bush has said, okay, if you see somebody who's Iranian in Iraq, shoot them. Let's have a do-it-yourself Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Let's see if we can blow up the USS Maine here. Let's have an excuse for a war. At the same time that Bush has said that any Iranians in Iraq can be shot, this from the New York Times today, James Glantz. Iran's ambassador to Baghdad outlined an ambitious plan on Sunday to greatly expand its economic and military ties with Iraq, including an Iranian national bank branch in the heart of the capital. Iran was prepared to offer government forces training, equipment, and advisors for what he called the security fight. In the economic area, Mr. Kumi says, this is the Iranian ambassador to Iraq. Mr. Kumi said, Iran was ready to resume major assume major responsibility for Iraq reconstruction. He says, we have experience of reconstruction after war, referring to the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. We are ready to transfer this experience in terms of reconstruction to the Iraqis. A senior Iraqi banking official, Hussein al-Uzri, confirmed that Iran would receive a license to open the bank. What? They're going to open an Iranian bank and then the U.S. soldiers are going to go in and shoot it up? Which he said would apparently be the first wholly owned subsidiary bank of a foreign country in Iraq. This will enhance trade between the two countries, Mr. Uzri said. Mr. Kumi said the bank was just the first of what he said would be several in Iraq, an agricultural bank and three private banks, also intended to open branches. Other elements of new economic cooperation, he said, include plans for Iranian shipments of kerosene and electricity to Iraq, and new agricultural cooperative involving both countries. And what are we going to do? Blow these things up as they come across the border? Lieutenant General William Odom, earlier this month, spoke about this before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I want to share some small pieces of that with you right after the break in just a minute. And also tell you my experience of being in Washington, D.C. on Saturday very quickly. And then we'll take your phone calls here at 866-440-8466, 440-THOM. Also, you can drop by our live chat room, TomHartmann.com, our website. Odom was asked, what's the situation in Iraq and what can be done? And I, in my opinion, his response, Lieutenant General William Odom's response to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in January of this year, has not gotten anywhere near enough press. Some of the things he said, truly mind-boggling. So I'll share that with you right after the break, along with what I saw in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartmann radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
No, 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 baby, no, 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 don't lie.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Telling the truth, some multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. You know how that is. 34 minutes past the hour. You know, I'm going to move Mr. General Odom, or most of General Odom, into the next hour just because, you know, I don't want to. A lot of folks on the phone line here we want to get to. And also, I wanted to tell you very quickly about my experience on Saturday. Saturday morning at the, there was a Lutheran church in Washington, D.C. And I'm forgetting the name of the church, but they had a interfaith spiritual service at 9:30 in the morning before the march, and I went down there, and Rabbi Arthur Washko of the Shalom Center gave an amazing talk. I'll tell you about it in just a second. Reverend Graylin Hagler, the Dean of African American Ministers in Washington, D.C., this description by Rabbi Michael Lerner, who gave the kind of the keynote. And disclosure here, Michael Lerner is an old friend of mine. I was on the advisory board of Tikkun magazine for a number of years, wrote a cover story for the magazine once. So anyhow, there was Bane Sutiya Dharma of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship led a chant, and there was a brilliant woman from the Muslim American Society, and I'm sorry I don't have her name right here in front of me. I had left at home the program, and it's not included in Michael's thing, but first of all, Arthur Washko, Rabbi Arthur Washko, he said, this was so cool. He said, the tetragrammaton, the four letters that make up the unspeakable name of God in Judaism, Yud Hey Yahweh, J-H-W-H, or Y, in English, Y-H-W-H. He said, you know, this is done without vowels, you know, of course that's Quranic, but he said, there's not supposed to be any vowels. It's not the big question about, you know, like mistranslating it as Jehovah or something, adding vowels to it. He said, if you say it without the vowels, what you get is. The JH is the. And the WH is the. He says, the breath. The name of God is breath. And he said, and it's all living things. All living things are saying the name of God with each breath. We are breathing in what the trees are breathing out, or the trees are breathing in what we are breathing out, and all living things are saying the name of God with every breath. I thought that was such a profound statement. I mean, it just all day long, I'm walking around noticing my breath and just thinking of that. It was extraordinary. So anyhow, this marvelous service, the church was packed to the gills. And then afterwards, I went up and said hi to Michael Lerner, and he and I and a few other people walked down to the protest. I had to leave fairly early because I had to catch a 6 o'clock flight out. So I wasn't there for the whole thing or even the majority of it. But what I was there for was huge, and it was wonderful to see all these people. And as my taxi was leaving New York City, heading out, you know, Washington D.C., excuse me, heading all around town trying to get to the highway, there were 20, 30 little neighborhoods, intersections where there would be 5, 10, 15 people standing on the corner with signs, you know, impeach Bush, no blood for oil, you know, get out of Iraq now, don't invade Iran, things like this. And I'm guessing that these were all people just from local neighborhoods stepping out into the streets. It was just the coolest thing. The other thing that I noticed, and that I'm really trying to figure out, I've been involved in anti-war activities since the 1960s and you know, back in the days when I was with Students for Democratic Society, over the last 5 years or so have been to a number of these peace demonstrations and protests and marches and whatnot. And I saw this exact same thing again on Saturday in Washington, D.C., and that is that there were a lot of people 25 years of age and younger, more or less, and a lot of people say 45 or 50 years of age and older, but it seems like there's a generational hole there between more or less 25 and more or less 45. And I don't understand what it is. Is it that age people are raising kids and they just can't take the time off? Or is it that we have, that the Republican war on the middle class has been so successful? 26 years, ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on the American middle class in 1981. 26 years of the war on the middle class has been so successful that people of that age, that major earnings age, are afraid of getting their picture in some database or on some website where a future employer might look at it and go, oh, a lefty. Or is it that they're not politically engaged? Is it that they came of age during the Reagan era when, you know, the primary meme was, you know, that government was an evil thing? And that political action was something you shouldn't bother with. Just leave it to the multinational corporations. I don't know. If you have some thoughts on that, you can share them with us. Our number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And Stuart in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Earlier you said something to the effect that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was the first time a major power invaded a country that posed no threat since Germany invaded Poland. I'm sure you weren't thinking about Vietnam at that moment.
You're absolutely right. I should have said it's the second time.
Yeah. An important point I want to stress is the war.
Well, actually, let me just pick a nit with you, Stuart.
Yes.
There actually was a South Vietnamese government. I mean, you know, it was put together by the French and all that, and it was largely a phony government. But there was a South Vietnamese government, and so we were not initially, anyway, invading Vietnam. We were assisting a friendly government, and I think that we can pick nits all day long about, you know, what that means and all that kind of stuff. But there really is a fundamental difference there. That was not an invasion of a sovereign nation that had committed no aggression against us in Vietnam, arguably at the beginning. I mean, you know, what's his name? Johnson had to have his Gulf of Tonkin phony thing, just like McKinley had to have the USS Maine, a phony thing, you know, to justify the Spanish-American War. But that's very different from attacking a country all by itself, Iraq, that represents no threat to you.
Okay, I'll you know, that's not very important concerning the more important point I want to stress.
Sure.
I want to stress that the war in Vietnam was a great success, just like the invasion of Iraq has been a great success, and how an attack on Iran would be a great success. That is a great success for the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers like Cheney's, Halliburton, and Bechtel, etc. So I think we all have to remember that these people aren't always failures when they do these things. Sometimes they're successes if you measure it in terms of an important driving force in their group is people pocketing lots of money from these wars.
Yeah. Good point, well made, Stuart. I am in complete agreement with you. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas. Hey, Vic.
Hey, Tom. Well, I second that last caller's notion about the success from that standpoint. Getting back to your guest.
Yes.
I guess he would recommend that we should dig up the war criminals at the end of the Nuremberg trial. Because the indictment from the count two of the indictment of the Nuremberg trials from World War II, they charged the defendants with committing specific crimes against peace by planning, preparing, initiating, and waging wars of aggression against a number of other states.
Right, and Poland specifically was one of the ones that was mentioned, one of the primary ones that was mentioned. I mean, there was the Anschluss and there was the Sudetenland, the invasion of Czechoslovakia, but Poland specifically was mentioned at the Nuremberg trials, and the people specifically tried and hung for invading Poland.
Right, my favorite part of it, the charges in the indictment that the defendants planned and waged aggressive wars, and charges of the utmost gravity. War is essentially an evil thing. Now, this is in the indictment. Its consequences are not confined to the belligerent states alone, but affect the whole world. To initiate a war of aggression, therefore, is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. They mentioned this. This is the indictment.
Yeah, no,
yet,
absolutely.
And yet we find ourselves indicted. I'm indicted. You're indicted.
I know.
Bush is indicted.
I know. We are suffering under an administration of war criminals. I am absolutely in agreement with you, Dwight Eisenhower, on this issue.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And is that what's going on here? Or is it just Bush? I mean, is it, you know, was Cindy Sheehan right when she said,
as a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
So, was it for oil? Was it for the military-industrial complex? Was it for political capital? Whatever it was wrong. 45 minutes past the hour.
Young man sitting on the witness stand. The man with the book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. The man looked down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Yeah, and they're still crying it. The lonely voice of youth is still speaking out. And a few old parts as well. What is truth? Scooter Libby is coming face-to-face with all that. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, regarding your Ayn Rand guest, you know, he justifies the bombing of Iran because he claims there's Al-Qaeda elements in Iran.
Yeah.
Now, that logic is so ludicrous and retarded. I mean, 9/11 was hatched by al-Qaeda elements in Hamburg, Germany, so does that mean we should bomb Germany?
Right, and Osama bin Laden is hanging out right now in Pakistan. Should we be bombing Pakistan?
Right, or the inverse is, you know, most 9/11 criminals were Saudis, so, but why are they considered innocent? I mean, it's...
Right, well, in fact, we rounded them up and flew... We didn't round them up. They rounded themselves up and flew home all by themselves.
But yeah. They keep using that retarded argument.
I know. It is... You're absolutely right, Tom. It is absolutely plain old flat-out crazy. Ransom, thanks for the call. Ransom in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Ransom.
Hey there. I just had a couple of questions. First off, how about the Reagan unjustified invasion of Grenada and the Bush unjustified invasion of Panama?
Yes, I agree with you that both of those were unjustified, inappropriate, uncalled for. There was a caveat in what I said, which was a major power invading a major power.
Oh,
and
major.
And which is usually what gets the attention of the world. I mean, you know, little countries get nailed all the time. And in Panama, we really didn't change their government. We just took Noriega out. We took out their leader and said, this guy's a criminal. The invasion of Grenada was equally unjustified. I decried it at the time, as did many of us. And yet it was a done deal. It was over with. And there was this excuse of the American students who were the last, they were looking around going, huh? We're having a good time. What's the deal? David in Granby, Massachusetts. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was listening to your Ayn Rand guy, and you just gotta love these guys who are willing to fight to the last drop of somebody else's blood to maintain our influence in the Middle East. The chilling thing is that this isn't some guy who was let out on a day pass from the asylum to come on your show. I mean, this guy seems to represent mainstream thinking.
Yes,
in the administration.
Yeah, in this administration, and in much of the media, by the way, as well. Absolutely. And that's why I say when you hear the word mainstream, you want to turn and run the other direction.
But I got another analogy, sure. Another quick analogy for you. It's all during the 70s and 80s when the IRA bombing campaign was going on, and it cost the lives of hundreds of British citizens. The Brits somehow managed to resist the temptation to send the RAF in to flatten Dublin.
Right, you're right. And in fact, they never declared war against the IRA. They declared them criminals, and that's how you deal with that kind of thing.
Yeah. I had a quick question for you about the march that you're going to talk about, I guess.
I think I've already kind of talked about it.
Okay, well, I wonder if you'd heard the theme that's kind of emerging from the right wing about how returning Iraq war vets are being spit on and abused personally by anti-war protesters in sort of a
You know, they made that up about the Vietnam guys, too, and it's been thoroughly debunked. There were no Vietnam vets who were spit on.
No, it's sort of a recirculation. It's a recirculation of the lie that started
Yeah, it's a vanishing hitchhiker story. It's nonsense. It was nonsense about Vietnam, and it's nonsense about Iraq.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I have a feeling that as the anti-war protests grow, that you're going to be hearing this theme more.
Oh, of course. Of course. These guys are professional liars, and nothing's going to stop them. Right. David, thank you for the call. John in San Francisco, California. Hey, John, what's up?
I was just reading Professor Edward Herman, the man from Wharton School of Economics, on ZMAG.org, and he was pointing out that the same kinds of lies that we heard about that dragged us into this catastrophe in Iraq are now being recirculated almost really shamelessly by the media and by the Bush administration with the collusion of the Democrats. It seems that some...
I agree. And the media are even logoing the stuff. I mean, the major TV network, you know, crisis in Iran. They're coming up now. They're getting ready. Oh, boy, another war. Our ratings are going to go up.
Yeah, after they've been exposed as being carrying water and peddling the same lies, they're now just changing the Q to an N and shamelessly peddling the same kind of stuff and ignoring the fact that the one who's actually threatening anybody around the world is the United States and Israel. Even the United Nations, the Security Council, Democrats and Republicans under the sway of this military-industrial complex and the Israeli lobby are just recycling these same lies despite the fact that Iran has stayed at home.
Well, I don't think you can point to a specific threat against any other country by Israel, but you certainly can by the United States, John. I absolutely agree with you. And they are recycling these lies, and they're setting up the exact same thing. It is deja vu all over again. Jackie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on WPTT. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you for bringing intelligence and sanity to the airwaves.
Well, I say our program is fair and slightly unbalanced.
Yeah, sorry. There's so much insanity out there. I said the word wrong.
It's okay.
But the reason you're not seeing a certain age group, I think you said 26 to 40, at the protest is we're just so tired. We're tired because the war on the middle class has been successful. We're trying to bring in two incomes to raise our families. We fear losing our jobs because that's equivalent to losing our house insurance. And I would love to get out and protest, but we're just too tired.
Yeah, I understand, Jackie. And in fact, that's one of my major speculations. And thank you for the call. In fact, in my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, that's the central premise, is that the conservatives looked at the two periods of time when we had a strong middle class in the United States, the 1770s and the 1970s, and said, well, we can't have this. Look at this. In both cases, the middle class got uppity. You know, in the 1770s, they fought off a king and the British East India Company. They overthrew a multinational corporation. In the 1970s, women were burning their bras and demanding equality. African Americans, gays, everybody wanted a place at the table. Can't have that! We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
$17,556,463. That's how many students could have gotten full four-year scholarships at public universities. Books, tuition, housing, everything. 17,556,465 full four-year scholarships just with the $362 billion we've spent so far in Iraq. And that's just what's been spent. Arguably, the cost, the real cost has been at least twice that. I mean, in so many other areas. So why? So what, you know, what's the deal here? What has happened? Lieutenant General William Odom, on January 18th, testified, just a few weeks ago, testified before the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said, you've asked me to address primarily the military aspects of the war. Now, this is really interesting, because here you are, you're asking a military guy about a war, and he comes back with an answer which is, frankly, not what I think the senators were expecting. He says, you've asked me to address primarily the military aspects of the war. Although I shall comply, I must emphasize that it makes no sense to separate them from the political aspects. Military actions are merely the most extreme form of politics. If politics is the business of deciding who gets what, when, and how, as Boss Tweed of Tammany Hall in New York once said, then the military aspects of war are the most extreme form of politics. As I pointed out, 17,556,479 full four-year scholarships could have been paid for with just what we spent so far on the war. I mean, that's just the beginning of it. We could have built 3,260,866 low-income homes. Housing units for low-income people. Built them and said, here, it's yours. I mean, when you just consider the cost, we could have hired with the $362,155,142,000, I'm watching a clock, it's counting up. With the $362 billion we've spent, we could have hired 6,276,193 additional public school teachers for a full year. All of this is, by the way, is over at costofwar.com. We could have given full health insurance, dental, eye care, everything to 216,859,423 children for a year. This is one dimension of what Odom is talking about. And in fact, it's what Dwight Eisenhower was talking about when he left office. I played you the most famous clip. We must never let the combination of the weight of these forces threaten our future and our safety. The military and the industrial complex. The military-industrial complex. Eisenhower actually went on to say that we must also not mortgage our future in its name.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
And that's exactly what Bush is doing. So anyhow, General Odom, carrying on these themes, oddly, well, you would expect, I guess, Dwight Eisenhower would have known something about it. He, after all, was the supreme Allied commander in Europe, the general who supervised the end of the war in Europe. But here's Lieutenant General William E. Odom saying the same thing. He says, we cannot have the slightest understanding of the likely consequences of proposed changes in our war policy without relating them to the strategic context. And then he goes on to say that there's four major realities that define that. Number one, confusion about war aims and U.S. interests. He says the president stated three war aims clearly and repeatedly: the destruction of Iraq, EWMD, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the creation of a liberal democratic Iraq. The first war aim is moot because Iraq had no WMD. The second was achieved by late spring of 2003. This, by the way, is why I say, why I refuse to refer to this as the war in Iraq. I refer to it as the occupation of Iraq. Because the war was over. When Bush got up, when he flew in, when he was flown in, he didn't fly that plane, he sat in the back seat. When he was flown in to the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and said,
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
When he said that, he was right. The war was over. We knocked down their government. We took their buildings. We took their institutions. Both military, government, and economic, for that matter. We seized their government. We took out their army. We won the war. Then began the occupation. So back to Lieutenant General Odom's testimony a few weeks ago. He said, today people are waking up to what was obvious before the war. The third aim, keep in mind, the first was WMD, the second was overthrowing Saddam Hussein. He said, we did both those. First of all, there was no WMD, and secondly, we took care of Saddam back in 2003. He said, the third aim, creation of a liberal democratic Iraq, has no real prospect of being achieved even in 10 or 20 years, much less in the short time anticipated by the war planners. Implicit in that aim was the belief that a pro-American post-Saddam regime could be established. This, too, it should be clear, is most unlikely. Finally, is it in the U.S. interest to have launched a war in pursuit of any of these aims? And is it in the U.S. interest to continue pursuing the third, that is the creation of liberal democratic Iraq? And is it time to redefine our aims and concomitantly to redefine what constitutes victory? Now, keep in mind, we're talking here about the four major realities. That's his first major reality. Confusion about war aims and U.S. interests. His second major reality that he said about the war, or the occupation, he refers to it as the war. He says, number two, the war has served primarily the interests of Iran and Al-Qaeda, not American interests. Yes, George Bush did exactly what Osama bin Laden was hoping he would do. Well, to quote General Odom, in his testimony before Congress, we cannot reverse this outcome by use of more military force in Iraq. To try to do so would require siding with Sunni leaders and the Ba'athist insurgents against pro-Iranian Shiite groups. The Ba'athist insurgents constitute the forces most strongly opposed to Iraqi cooperation with Iran. See, what he's pointing out is that you can't win for losing. If we side with the Shia in Iraq, they're going to end up in a coalition with Iran, which is not what we wanted. And if we side with the Sunnis, which is what Saudi Arabia is telling us to do, you're going to end up with a country that once again is ruled by a minority, another strong man. You're going to have another Saddam Hussein. Well, back to General Odom. At the same time, our democratization policy has installed Shiite majorities and pro-Iranian groups in power in Baghdad, especially in the ministries of Interior and Defense. However, our counterinsurgency operations are, as unintended but easily foreseeable consequences, first, a greater Shiite openness to Iranian influence, and second, al-Qaeda's entry into Iraq and rooting itself into some elements of Iraqi society. So we blew that. What is the third major reality, according to General Odom? He says, on the international level, the war has effectively paralyzed the United States militarily and strategically, denying it any prospect of revising its strategy toward an attainable goal. And fourth, he says, overthrowing the Iraqi regime in 2003 ensured that the country would fragment into at least three groups, Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. In other words, the invasion made it inevitable that a civil war would be required to create a new central government able to control all of Iraq. Yet a civil war does not ensure it. No faction may win the struggle. A lengthy stalemate or a permanent breakup of the country is possible. The invasion also ensured that outside countries and groups would become involved. Al-Qaeda and Iran are the most conspicuous participants so far, but Turkey and Syria are less so. If some of the wealthy oil-producing countries in the Arabian Peninsula are not already involved, they're most likely to support with resources any force in Iraq that opposes Iranian influence. We have opened the gates of hell. The neocons refer to it as the greater chaos theory. Well, yep, we have our greater chaos. And it's increasingly looking like there is no good way out of it other than to get out of it. 16 minutes past the hour.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lives of the people running round their castles are burned. Our eyes see change, but inside we're the same as we ever were.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and slightly unbalanced, 21 minutes past the hour. It's listener-supported radio, our program supported. And frankly, all progressive programming, all talk radio, really, but in particular, I'd like you to note our program supported by you, our listeners, listening to your local radio station for the advertisers and supporting them, buying their products, calling them up and letting them know that you're listening. As well as our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW, 380-M-E-O-W. And did I say 866? I think it's 800. Well, I'll have to track that down. Anyhow. As I was sharing with you General Odom's perspective and the grand overview here, the large overview, the big deal, and this is a big deal, the big deal here, is that he's saying basically there is no way forward. There is none. We've blown it. We are simply making it worse. He says, many critics argue that had the invasion been done right, such as sending in larger forces for reestablishing security and government services, the war could have been a success. This argument is not convincing. Such actions might have delayed a civil war, but could not have prevented it. He said, therefore, any military programs or operations having the aim of trying to reverse this reality, insisting that we can now do it right, need to be treated with the deepest of suspicion. That includes the proposal to sponsor the breakup by creating three successor states. To do so would be to preside over the massive ethnic cleansing operations required for the successor states to be reasonably stable. Ethnic cleansing is happening in spite of the U.S. military in Iraq, but I see no political or moral advantage to the United States becoming its advocate. We are already being blamed as its facilitator. He says it is a strategic error of monumental proportions to view the war as confined to Iraq. Yet this is the implicit assumption on which the president's new strategy is based. And he goes on and on with this. He talks about the Iraq study group. He says, this is all well and good what they say. And it lets the Republicans speak out. Finally, they have something. He said the key weakness, however, in its proposals is that it does not concede that the war, as it was conceived and continues to be fought, is not winnable. It rejects the rapid withdrawal of U.S. forces as unacceptable. No doubt a withdrawal will leave a terrible aftermath in Iraq, but we cannot avoid that. We can only make it worse by waiting until we are forced to withdraw. In the meantime, we prevent ourselves from escaping the paralysis imposed on us by the war. Unable to redefine our war aims, which have served Iranian and Al-Qaeda interests instead of our own. This is Lieutenant General William Odom. So what would a revised strategy look like? What war aim today is genuinely in the U.S. interests? And not just in Iraq, but in the larger region? He says, since the 1950s, the U.S. aim in this region has been regional stability. The strategy for achieving this aim of every administration until the present one, this is really an important point, up until the Bushies, the way that we've achieved regional stability is by maintaining a regional balance of power among three regional forces, the Arabs, the Israelis, and the Iranians. He points out the Arab-Persian conflict is older than the Arab-Israeli conflict. The United States kept a diplomatic foothold on all three camps until the fall of the Shah's regime in Iran. Losing its footing in Tehran, it began under President Carter's leadership to compensate by building what he called the Persian Gulf Security Framework. The Reagan administration, though it condemned Carter's Persian Gulf Security Framework, the so-called Carter Doctrine, continued Carter's policies, even to the point of supporting Iraq when Iran was close to overrunning it. He says some of Reagan's relations with Iran were feckless and counterproductive, but it maintained the proper strategic aim, regional stability. The Bush administration has broken with this strategy by invading Iraq and also by threatening the existence of the regime in Iran. It presumed that establishing a liberal democracy in Iraq would lead to regional stability. In fact, the policy of supporting democracy by forces of arms has become the main source of regional instability. He says this also increases greatly the threats to Israel's security, the very thing it was supposed to improve. His summary, the only thing that we can do, the thing that we can do, is get out of Iraq right now. Just pull out and let them reorganize it. What it'll do is it'll cause the other nations in the region to come in and defend their particular interests, and ultimately stability will come to the region. What else is there? 27 minutes past the hour.
I want the truth to set me free. I wish the violence would leave.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Just a few quickies here. President Bush, oh man, this is from Cleveland.com. His proposal to create a tax deduction for health insurance, if enacted into law, could reduce Social Security benefits for many Americans because the deduction would apply not only to income taxes but also to payroll taxes that go to Social Security. The bottom line, Bush's whole health proposal thing is a way of pumping up HSAs, these health savings accounts. It's a way of pumping up and helping out the rich folks and screwing the rest of America. It's a way of encouraging employers to stop offering employer-based health care and throw more and more of that responsibility on your shoulders and mine, thus further privatizing health care and moving us farther and farther away from an egalitarian society, farther and farther away from a world where health care is considered a right and not a privilege, farther and farther away from where the other 36 of the other 30, where 36 of the other 37 major industrialized nations of the world are at right now and have been for decades. Nancy Pelosi apparently agrees with the rant I've been sharing with you over at the San Francisco Chronicle. She says, she recently went to Iraq, and she says, this trip, she says, has made her even more certain of her view that moving troops out of Iraq is the best way to bring stability to the region. She said, I believe redeployment of our troops is a step towards stability in the region. You get it? I mean, from the politicians to the generals, people are, and the Republicans, Bush and Cheney, if they don't think
that we should be escalating, they should come up with a plan of their own.
Well, Democrats do have a plan of their own. It's been out there for a couple of years. At least a year. Let's pull back from the primary areas. Let's redeploy over the horizon, as I believe the phrase. And bring it, let's let diplomacy work. If you agree with General Odom that war is politics on steroids, it's part of the political process, then let's engage in the political process. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Jeanette in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jeanette, welcome to the program.
Hey, hi, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I saw your talk on your book, Screwed, here a couple of times, and it was just wonderful.
So well,
congratulations
you.
On that. I'm calling really about the comment you made earlier as a question. Any observations about the group 25 to 45, why they're less politically active?
I'm not sure that they're less politically active. They may be more politically active on the Internet, for example. Maybe they're the ones who are
right.
Spending
in
all those in
person.
But why are they not showing up at the protests?
And you were talking about, you know, the fear that some employers are going to see that they were out there. And I think that maybe it's not so much that as it is a sort of nose to the grindstone thing I see in that age group, a certain belief that their major wage earning years are before 40, and then after 40, the bottom will fall out. And I remember certain things that happened here in Seattle. I think in the early, maybe the late 80s, corporations firing anybody over 40. There was some big spread in the Sunday Times. And then earlier than that, when the software industry had the bottom fall out, a lot of young age earners that were making mega bucks all of a sudden were struggling.
So people in that generation are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder from the war against the middle class that Reagan initiated.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we did a middle-class support group here for about 8, 9, 10 years in Seattle, and I got to listen to a lot of the concerns of the middle class, and a lot more angst. I saw a lot more angst in the men, although some of the working women had that going, too.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I think you're right on in terms of the war against the middle class. There's, you know, Barbara Ehrenreich, her book, you know, Nickel and Dimed, all of that stuff is really important.
Yeah.
And I also have a feeling that there's a division going on with the younger age earner and the baby boomer age earner, as the baby boomers are inheriting wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain sort of discomfort between the two groups then.
Yeah.
It's so much easier for the baby boomer generation.
Although what's so amazing is I know so many people of the baby boomer generation, people in their 50s and early 60s, whose parents have died and left absolutely nothing, even though that was the, quote, greatest generation, right? Even though they owned their home, they worked all their lives. But what happened was, in their old age, in order to be able to qualify for Medicare, for nursing care, you know, for long-term nursing care, they had to basically bankrupt themselves. There is a death tax in this country that hits the middle class almost without exception. I mean, I know a lot of people whose parents in their 70s and 80s, went into retirement with $100,000 in the bank, $500,000, $1 million in the bank, and by the time they were done with the health care system in this country, had absolutely nothing to pass on to their children.
And there you go again. It's the same message for the 25 to 45-year-old. You better do it while you're young.
Yep, there's going to be nothing for you. Thank you, Jeanette, for the call. Good to hear from you. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Say, I was charmed by your report of the rabbi discussing how the name of God is actually our breath.
Rabbi Arthur Washkow of the Shalom Center.
It stirred my mind because, although this may seem a bit of a stretch, I think it's not, the pre-lifers who are against abortion talk about biblical sanction. And it's often been said that abortion is never mentioned in the Bible. But in fact, in Genesis 2, chapter 7, the beginning of life is described when God forms human beings from dirt and then breathes the breath of life into their nostrils and they become human beings.
Yes, that metaphor of the first breath as the beginning of life appears at least a half a dozen times in the Bible and is, you know, very common among indigenous societies and it's an interesting one and one that the anti-abortion crowd doesn't want to go along with, and you can bring science into all this and turn into a very confusing debate. But what I got out of it, Bob, was his saying that the tetragrammaton, those four letters, if you actually pronounce them, it becomes the breath, right?
Yeah.
That is the interconnectedness of all life, and we are not only waging a war against the people of Iraq. We are waging a war against all kinds of life forms in Iraq. I mean, war is pretty indiscriminate in its killing. It doesn't just kill human beings. It doesn't just render wastelands, land, uninhabitable for human beings. It renders it uninhabitable for virtually everything.
It's also true that the Buddhists in any meditation is a concentration on breathing.
Yes, absolutely, and as is Hindu meditation as well. And for that matter, much Christian and Jewish meditation has to do with noticing the breath. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Jason.
Yes, hi. I don't mean to call names, and I'm getting like more and more angry as I hear more and more stuff. But if Americans, and I'm really sorry about my language, if Americans are this stupid to allow what's going on to happen, then, and I mean, it's not enough, of course, to, be involved in a political rally and all that, but if they do not vote, if they do not demand to hold their elected officials, elected representatives, they are not leaders, they're representatives, to do what we tell them to do. If we let this continue on, then, we deserve what we get.
Yeah, broadly, I don't disagree with you, and that's why this program is a continuous call to action. We have to become activists. As the people who created this country were activists, as the people who brought about the major transformations in this country, whether it was abolition or whether it was suffrage or whether it was the civil rights movement or whether it was the end of the Vietnam War, or for that matter, activists getting in, volunteering for World War II, whatever the form of activism might have been, we have to be active as well. Just sitting back and voting isn't enough. It's just not even close to enough. And, well, again, back to Eisenhower, his speech in 1961 as he was leaving office on his way out. Here's just one last clip from that as he talks about this. The same issue.
During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
Intellect, decent purpose, not be a community of fear and hate? I mean, that was a real Republican president, and actually a you know, a decent man. It is amazing. It's just amazing how far America has slid from, and the Republican Party. I remember Jim Jeffers, the only Republican I ever voted for when I lived in Vermont, my senator. Jim Jeffords and Pat Leahy were our senators. I remember when he left the Republican Party, he said, I didn't leave my party. My party left me. They went nuts. He was right. He was absolutely right. The people running this country, the Republicans running this country, obviously now the Democrats have taken control of the House and Senate. We have to hold them accountable. And the Republicans, they've gone over the edge. They're irredeemable. It's 45 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a clean environment, a clean boat. About the end of voting machines, we take that. We take a clean election, we really would. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Linda in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Linda, Lydia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was looking at the poll numbers that came out today. If 70% of the public is against the war, this isn't just Democrats that are. It must be Republicans there also. Why aren't they holding their representatives accountable by calling and emailing and doing what they need to do to cut off the funding?
Well, I think only about 30% of the American electorate is actually registered as Republican, and it's something like 31% Republican, 32% Democratic, or maybe it's the other way around. So it may be that 70% is all the Democrats and all the independents, but I suspect not. I suspect that you're right, that there are a lot of Republicans who are very unhappy with this, and they should be holding their elected officials accountable, just as perhaps even more important, Democrats, Greens, progressives right across the board, all of us who believe in the fundamental and foundational vision of this country, who believe in the idea of peace, who believe in diplomacy before war, need to be holding our elected representatives accountable. The fact of the matter is, though, that the Republicans are probably less likely to do it because the Republican Party has done a very, very good job of fostering a herd mentality, you know, a sheep mentality, and it's all about the next election, whereas Democrats have historically been about activism.
But, that is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is. But I think that it's really, really critical, and thank you, Lydia, for the call. I think it's really, really critical that we all get out there and get active. It's all about the parade. I'm telling you, it's all about the parade. It's all about us being active. Without us speaking out, our politicians will not have the intestinal fortitude or, you know, whatever cliche you want to use to actually take the strong positions that need to be taken. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Tom, you had remarked on the the part of the small sentence or two there and the President's State of the Union speech last week, where he said that chaos is our most important ally.
You're right. A bit of a Freudian slip there.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Beyond that, order out of chaos, which in the Latin is ordo ad chao, is actually been around for at least hundreds of years, and it's been used as a main strategy for the global elite to accomplish their agenda.
Yeah, and the neocons right now, and Congressman Peter DeFazio is actually one of the most articulate people in pointing this out, who represents probably you, I think, in Florence.
Yes, sir.
Peter DeFazio points out that the neocons actually have a whole set of language around this. They talk about, you know, organized chaos and how chaos is going to bring about order and all that kind of thing. And if you throw the cards up in the air when they come down, they'll come down in a different way, and won't that be a great thing? And you know, he thinks they're nuts. I think they're nuts. The neocons believe that if they can create enough chaos, that out of it will come a new form of stability. Well, it will be a new form of stability, but it may not be one that's good for us. It may not be one that's good for those people living there. And it certainly won't be one that's good for all the people who are traumatized, whose lives are torn apart, whose children are killed, whose land is destroyed and covered with depleted uranium and munitions and unexploded bomblets and all the other ungodly horrors of war. It's not going to be good for any of them and all the other living things in that same area.
Well, amen, Tom. They give no credence or value to the things that are the most valuable under God's creation. They're actually of Satan. But I just wanted to say, if you could, Tom, please consider the idea of having Alex Jones come on to your show and lay out the before, during, and after evidence of 9/11 2001.
Oh, sure. Alex has been on the show several times, as has who's the guy who wrote the book? Well, in any case, yes. We've done that in the past. I'm sure we will again in the future.
All right.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you know, Tom, Bush is the most pathetic fraud that the billionaires have ever installed in the White House. Case in point.
I'm assuming the Bush you're speaking of, because you're calling from Sarasota, Florida, is not Jeb.
Right. I'm talking about W stands for worthless and weasel.
I see. Okay.
Okay. Here he talks about the middle class don't need Medicare and Social Security. He wants to move them away from it. At the same time, he says that socialism's bad, but it's okay that the middle class pick up the Medicaid socialization cost for the illegals that he uses to bring into this country with open borders while he's got a war and terror to destroy the wages of the working class and to have odds of 10 to 20 to 1 for every job that's in the United States so that it'll just permanently push the wages down to the working class.
Yep. It's all about their strategy of their trickle down economic strategy where you end up with a powerful ruling elite and a bunch of peons. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, just a few seconds before we have to wrap the show up. What's up?
Two comments. I'm wondering if Odom will now be forced out for talking so frankly and intelligently. And also,
I think he already has. I think he's retired.
And my other point is that there's a flaw in the thinking that down, that what we could have done domestically with all that money is a moot point because we don't have that money.
You're right. It's all borrowed. It's all borrowed. You're absolutely right. Good point, Jackie. Thank you very much. Oh, my. We'll be back. Evan Goodstein is going to be with us, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College, about the focus of the nation. And we'll be taking your calls and more news of the day here at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOM, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Eben Goodstein is with us. He's with Focus the Nation, focusthenation.org. He's also a professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College. Eben, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom, thanks a lot. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you with us. You guys are coordinating teams of faculties and students at over 1,000 universities and K through 12 schools in the United States to let you tell the story. To do what?
Well, you got the vision. January 31st, 2008, which is a year from this January, we're going to be coordinating at over 1,000 colleges, universities, high schools. One day, a simultaneous discussion of global warming solutions for America. So it's a national teach-in, but it's really a lot more than that.
And what more is it than that?
Well, we're going to be bringing together throughout all of next fall on campuses across the country. Faculty are going to be engaging with students, talking about global warming solutions. The event is already beginning to spill out and attract the attention of the faith community, civic organizations, businesses, and they're going to be involved. And then on the day of January 31st itself, a year from now, we're going to be asking all of those campuses to end the event in the same way by inviting political leaders, senators, congressmen, mayors, city councilors to come to campus, sit down, engage with tens of thousands of young people about their future.
We're talking with Evan Goodstein, FocusTheNation.org, the website. He's a professor at Lewis and Clark, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College. Given that you're a professor of economics, Dr. Goodstein, let me just play a short clip. This is an ad that Adbusters put together a couple of years ago about how we measure economic growth and all that sort of thing.
Okay.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Is that a piece of what you're doing, talking about how we really need to consider recalibrating what we consider valuable and not valuable?
Well, Tom, I think what we're talking about is our children's future. You know, I've got a couple of kids, one's in college, and with global warming, what we're talking about, a couple of challenges. I mean, you and me, our generation right now, we have to stabilize global warming pollutants in the next decade. But when my daughter is my age, pushing 50, the mission of her generation is going to be to rewire the entire planet with clean energy technology solutions, and that's really the only way they're going to be able to lay the foundation for a just and sustainable and prosperous future for those kids. So, yeah, I mean, economists are, you know, mismeasuring growth and well-being in some ways, but right now it's less about what's wrong with the economics profession and more about what we need to do in the very short term to provide our kids with the tools that they're going to need to really create a livable planet for their kids.
Specifically?
Well, like I said, I mean, we have to stabilize global warming pollutants this decade. By the time Emma and my daughter is my age, they're going to have to be making cuts on the order of 10 to 15% per decade. They're really going to need us to invest now in the biofuels technologies and the solar arrays and the wind turbines, because those technologies take 15, 20 years to mature. The idea is if we move now, we can drive down the prices so that they will actually have the tools they need when they get to be, when their generation's running the world, to really do what they need to do for their kids.
Yeah, well said. This. I think that there's a bigger picture here, two of them, Evan Goodstein. One being the whole issue of global warming and how do we, I mean, for example, Al Gore saying maybe we should forget about the income tax and go to a carbon tax.
Yeah.
I mean, some really huge systemic changes in perspective. The other is a historic change in perspective that I think that is really at the core of our society. If I may play another clip for you, this is Bobby Kennedy on GNP, on gross national product.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community value in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifles and Speck's knives and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
And there's a fundamental disconnect here between just the idea of we can do it a little differently. We can do it a little better. Maybe we just change energy sources on the one hand to how about a fundamental shift in values?
Well, it's hard to follow that eloquence. I mean, he says it better than anybody has said it probably in the subsequent decades. But the purpose of Focus the Nation is to create exactly that kind of national conversation. I mean, he didn't mention the fact that as we're pumping the atmosphere full of carbon dioxide, thickening the planet's blanket that's surrounding the planet, that we're also now talking about the loss of the potential loss of polar ice caps and sea level rise on the order of 40 feet and inundating all the major coastal cities and the collapse of the Amazon rainforest and all of these things, just sort of mind-boggling global impacts associated with global warming. I mean, those are things we have to talk about. To what extent do they flow from our consumers' lifestyles? To what extent can we mitigate those using alternative energy technologies? We really owe our young people a day of focused conversation about this, more than a day, and that's really what we're intending to deliver with Focus the Nation.
So Focus the Nation is to begin the conversation in a very real way.
In a very real way, in a national, a serious and engaged national way. Universities and colleges across the country, but also engaging our political leaders, because we have a very short window of time if we're seriously going to be address these issues. If we're going to hold global warming to the low end, 3-4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty much what's already locked in, and that in and of itself is going to be very serious for hundreds of millions of people. It's going to drive a lot of animals and plants into extinction, but it's something we can manage.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry, if we're going to hold it to the low end, then we have to act in the next 4 or 5 years to stabilize global warming pollutants, but also more importantly, and just as importantly, to begin to invest tens of billions of dollars annually in those clean energy solutions that our kids are desperately going to need in 2030, 2040, when they have to make those deep, deep cuts in global warming pollutants.
Now, right now we're seeing enormous chunks of the Arctic thaw. You know, the permafrost in Siberia, the permafrost up around from Alaska or across the northern coast of Canada. We're seeing large chunks of sea ice that are now seawater. And GreenWire reports, and I'll just quote 2 sentences from this report. The Arctic region contains a quarter of the world's remaining oil reserves, experts estimate. It also contains massive natural gas fields in the Barents Sea, including Russia's huge Shchukotkan field. By 2040 or 2050, the Arctic Ocean will be navigable, and that will mean significant developments very soon, said ArcticNet Research Group head Martin Fortier. In other words, the oil companies are seeing this like a gold rush. In fact, this is European Environment Agency head Jacqueline McGlade. She says, the region's opening could lead to another rush like the Klondike gold rush, which could potentially destabilize the area and its 10 million indigenous inhabitants. Not to mention dragging another couple hundred billion pounds of tons of carbon out of the ground and putting it back into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Well, I think that that's the reason that this global warming movement that's growing right now is, I think, really going to fundamentally reshape the political economy of the 21st century. I mean, we just have to recognize that all those carbon deposits, all that coal, all that oil, all that natural gas, it took the natural world tens of millions of years.
Hundreds of millions of years
to suck that stuff out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Well, since the Cretaceous, so 40 million years ago. And we cannot burn it in 100 years without returning ourselves to that kind of a world. I mean, already the scientists are telling us, under a business-as-usual scenario, we're talking about a 6.
It won't work. Hey, Evan Goodstein, FocusTheNation.org, the website. Evan, thanks for being with us today. Good luck on what you're doing.
Tom, my pleasure. Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. Back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman radio program. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop by our live chat room, Blueberry Pickin in the chat room says, Tom, I think it's time someone on the air mentioned the new pain raise. DIME technology, sonic technology designed to disperse crowds, and the impact on dehumanization, the Milgram effect. The Milgram effect, of course, crank that voltage up a little more. Crank that voltage up a little more. Basically turning people into nice, compliant little robots, even if it means killing. Yeah, we're coming up with some really spiffy new weapons here. It's downright spooky. 1-866-440-8466, excuse me, our telephone number. Alex in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Alex, what's on your mind today?
Oh, just the hypocrisy thing going over with this Malaki crew, the Shias, where they go along and they get this, where they get American vehicles, American uniforms, they can go through all these checkpoints, and then, you know, they go unchecked and they go kill five guys like this.
This is the big problem, is that people forget the fact, Americans by and large have forgotten the fact, or never were aware of the fact, that the primary loyalty that people have in Iraq, and in most countries like Iraq, are to family and clan and tribe, and then to religion, and then, you know, ultimately to nation, and we go in saying, oh, it's, you gotta be a nation like America, the great melting pot, we're all in this together. And the Iraqis are going, no, I'm sorry, I'm a, you know, this guy is my sheikh, and I'm a member of this particular family, or this particular clan, and, you give me a uniform and a weapon, and you put me in some other clan's territory, and I'm gonna take advantage of that, I'm gonna whack these guys. Yeah, absolutely right, Alex, and stupidity is not a strong enough word with which, you know, Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and all of these guys, these neocons, went into this thing. And the price in blood that it has drawn is mind-boggling. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you. While I was listening today, I've heard several times on our 1090 AM that the blood banks are now going to start identifying the DNA. And the interesting part, it's a request from the Defense Department, but there was no other information given out.
You're kidding.
Yes.
That's one that slipped by my radar, but I'll take a look at that. Jude, thank you very much.
Well,
What
I did want to share with you, Tom, was you had mentioned about the breath again back in D.C.
Right.
And here we had about 2,000 people and women in standing, you know, we just
in Seattle.
In Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And we just carried the white flowers and were silent. And before I knew it, we were surrounded by the Buddhist peace movement. So we had the monks with us and we were walking. And the interesting thing that occurred is there was so much diversion going on, people yelling, I mean, orderly. But each time we would walk through, everyone would step back or become very quiet and very respectful. And it just is, it's a statement so much that there's such power with peace.
Yes.
And to remind the women or men that would like to be part of Women Standing, at the end of our vigil, we do it at 2:00 every day now, sometimes just on street corners by ourselves. At the end of it, we exhale the peace that we have housed for that hour vigil into the world.
Oh, that's marvelous, Jude. Thank you for sharing that. Anybody who thinks that peace is not powerful need only look at what Gandhi did in India, overthrew the British Empire, the most powerful military force and economic force in the world, Gandhi, with nonviolence. A Jesus promoting nonviolence, a religion that survived for 2,000 years. Nelson Mandela in South Africa bringing down apartheid with nonviolence. I mean, there is incredible power, not just the moral power. There is incredible power in peace. Scott in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott.
Well, and there's also power in the Internet, okay? Just to give you some context, you know, as far as people being involved in the anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
I'm 52. On my 14th birthday in 68, when I grew up near the D.C. area, my first demonstration was at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
The next year we had in October and November something like 500,000 people at the Vietnam War Moratorium March in Washington.
So what's your theory, Scott, about why people between 25 and 45 are by and large not showing up for these things?
Apathy has got to be the thing, because we got that group of people together with mimeograph machines and a ragtag assortment of underground newspapers around the country. You know, with the Internet today and things like MySpace, there's just no excuse.
Maybe it's something that is inculcated when you're young. Maybe if as a teenager you're exposed to protest you know, it becomes part of you. I was literally in the streets when I was 16 years old, you know, marching in the streets of East Lansing, Michigan, and having tear gas shot at me. And it's in my DNA now. And now we have another generation of kids growing up who are in the middle of a god-awful war, and they're out there marching. But there was that group in the middle who really didn't see any protest as teenagers. Maybe it's something that you learn in your teens and it stays with you. I don't know. Or maybe it's just, you know, Reagan's war against the middle class. Got a lot of people out there working. But I'm curious, you know, where are the 25 to 45-year-olds? I know, actually, we can, you know, we look at the demographics on radio shows. I know that they're listening. It's just, where are they? 27 minutes past the hour.
You always won every time you placed a bet. You're still damn good. No one's gotten to you yet. Every time they were sure to have you caught, you were quicker than they. You just turned your back and walked. And you always said.
And welcome back. Place for being progressive. Never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. The Vietnam VoteVets.org and the Americans Against Escalation in Iraq have launched a new ad campaign. This is interesting. It's over. There's a YouTube version of it. And you can get a piece of it. Here's a sample.
When it comes to Iraq, America's divided.
On one hand, you've got two-thirds of the American people.
A bipartisan majority in Congress.
These are all veterans.
The Iraq Study Group.
And veterans like us, all opposed to the escalation.
On the other hand, there's George Bush, who supports escalation. If you support escalation, you don't support the troops.
Join the troops. Stop the escalation.
And then it says, join the troops, stop the escalation, votevets.org. Powerful, powerful piece. The one guy who's going, on the other hand, you've got George Bush, and he doesn't have a hand. He's an amputee. It's a remarkable piece of advertising. 1-866-440-8466. Deuce in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on WPTT. Hey, Deuce, what's
hey,
up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Hey, look, what I'm calling about is this Jefferson Rule 603.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that states that if a state legislature submits a proposition for impeachment, that it's considered as high privilege and it takes precedent over any other business that the House of Representatives has to deal with. Now, some states have already did it. I don't see why. They don't
No states have done it. No states. What state has done it?
Vermont has done it.
Vermont is debating it.
Okay, yeah.
They have not completed. New Mexico is debating it. You have several states where in the state legislatures these debates are going on right now, but no state has passed that piece of resolution, I guess. I'm not sure you can call it legislation.
I'm working on it in Pennsylvania, so we're going to have a few problems. But once it comes in, they need to get this show on the road. He has to go.
Once it comes in, with you, Deuce.
It takes priority over everything else.
I'm right there with you.
Well, anybody listening, get in touch with your state representatives, and let's get this show on the road.
There you go. Okay. Well said, Deuce. Thanks a lot. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just want to point out that there's a movie called Jesus Camp. It's now been released on video. You can get it to a local store.
You get to see the wonders of Reverend Ted Haggard on there, don't you?
That's correct, yeah. And it really points out what we're up against in terms of the way the fundamental Christian movement has kind of taken over the decision-making process.
Yeah, I call them Christianists. Speaking as a Christian...
They have a radio talk show host on there who's a very devout Christian himself, who's pointing out how little what they're talking about has to do with Christianity.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I call them Christianists. I consider myself a Christian. And I don't believe that my religious perspectives or beliefs or goals or thoughts or whatever should have anything to do with public policy and law. That is a whole separate arena. The Muslimists, for example, who want to make Sharia law, the Christianists who want to use the Bible for law, You pick your religion, right? There's a number of countries around the world have a whole variety of religions basically running them, and I think it's a mistake. And frankly, I don't consider these folks Christians. I consider them Christianists, and all the more dangerous at that. So, Tupac, and thank you for the call, though. And interesting to know it's in DVD. Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Tupac, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I was really appreciate your earlier guest that talked about the Global Warming Initiative at the youth level, national.
Yes.
But also... an appreciation for your program as well. You're one of the few programs that I've heard mention the concept of indigenous peoples. You seem to do it on a regular basis. And I think that's an important part of the analysis that is missing that brings us to this situation where the public as a whole is not informed and doesn't take action.
I agree.
I think one of the other things, too, that is needed is to bring that perspective into present tense and future as well. As indigenous peoples, for example, here in Phoenix, we hosted Dr. Walter Reed in a presentation from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment that was commissioned by the UN, where all of these issues were brought forward at a planetary level. Top scientists of the world brought forth this study, and a lot of these policy questions were framed for us at a community level on actions that we need to take.
Mm-hmm.
What I was also curious was that on November 28th, I was hoping that this might be an area of interest or subject for your programming. On November 28th, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was basically put on hold in the Third Committee of the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the...
In part by the United States.
Well, the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, the Anglophile bloc of countries
right.
directly held responsible for putting that declaration on hold. They fought it for 25 years. We finally
right.
got it to the General Assembly and the bloc took place.
Right, and that's also the bloc of countries that have been most responsible for the destruction of indigenous people across the planet.
Exactly. And now with what you mentioned, you know, with the Arctic, the melting of the Arctic and that opening of that territory for the, what I call the Petropolis. The wars
mm-hmm.
that I see now, these are wars of Petropolis.
Yep.
They're not only transnational, they're metanational corporations. They have
yes.
nothing to do with national allegiances anywhere to any peoples in the world.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you. Tupac, thank you very much for your call and for your comments. You know, I was invited to participate in a conference that Carol Bedrosian put on. She publishes a magazine out of Massachusetts called Spirit of Change, and she's married to a Native American, and it has a large Native American readership and deals an awful lot with indigenous and Aboriginal issues. And the conference that she put on, she invited elders from a whole variety of traditions. There was a fellow from the Amazon, from the jungles of the Amazon who came up. There was a fellow from the mountains of the Amazon. In fact, he brought a big bundle of coca leaf with him that was interesting to chew on for a few minutes. There was a fellow from Africa, an African, a shaman who was there. There was a representative of African Americans, an elder from the African American community. There were several elders from the Native American community, both from Canada and from the United States. One of them, a fellow by the name of Frank, who I've known for a few years and who sat next to me. And Frank actually just died last year. And I was the elder for the white guys, right? I mean... And I'm sitting here, and there's, I don't know, 400 people, 500 people, something like that. There's a bunch of people in the audience, and most of them were in young people, you know, in their teens and 20s. And most of them were Caucasian. Most of them were middle class. And a lot of them were dressed up like Native Americans. You know, they were dressed up in buckskin and all this kind of stuff. And Frank and I they had this kind of elders circle. We were sitting around in this circle around the fire, and then around us is another circle, and then, you know, around that is all this community, and there was going to be this talking circle thing among the elders. And Frank leans over to me, and he looks out at all these kids in drag, you know, in Native American garb, and he says, I don't get it. He says, I don't understand why your people would want to be like my people. We have been the victims of 400 or 500 years of oppression. I mean, we're crushed. where our communities are in shambles. They're in tatters. We have terrible problems in our reservations with alcoholism and unemployment and child abuse. Why would you want to emulate us? And I thought about it for a minute. I thought, you know, this is a really interesting question. And it suddenly clicked. And I said, Frank, and I'm doing this from memory, and it's been quite a few years, so forgive me, but I actually wrote a piece about this called The Forgotten People at the time, and it's a lot more accurate. It's on my website. But here's my recollection. I said, Frank, you know the language of your mother's 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 mother all the way back into ancient history. And he said, yeah. I said, you know where the sacred places are and where the dangerous places are. He said, yes. I said, you know the sacred plants and foods. You know the traditions. You know the directions of the wind. You know who the spirits. You know the stories of your culture. He said, yes. And I said, now imagine if my ancestors had been successful at doing what they set out to do to your people, and you no longer knew your own language, and you no longer knew who your ancestors were, and you no longer knew what the sacred places were, and you knew nothing of that, what would that be? And he looked at me with this very sad face, and he said, that would be a disaster beyond comprehension. And I said, well, Frank, that's what happened to my people. 3,000 years ago in Europe, my people were Aboriginal people just like yours are, or were a few hundred years ago. And then came the Celts, and then came the Romans, and then came the Christians. And in my great-grandfather's house in Norway, there's a stone in the back with runic writing on it, and nobody alive in Norway today knows what it says. And it's not even 1,000 years old. And he looked at me with, you know, a different look, and he said, my God, your people have been destroyed. And I said, you're right. He said, no wonder you're hungry ghosts. 45 minutes past the hour.
Strangers on the right, invading Congress. Strangers on the right, impeding progress. They'll put up a fight. True liberals like you. Something in their eyes resembles fire. Roe v. Wade's demise is their desire. Cutting down to size those states that still are blue.
And welcome back to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no RNC passes required. We won't drag you off if you have a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. The Tom Hartman radio program here with you. Victoria Jones on the line from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. I've got something that I think will be of interest to you.
And that is?
Well, it's the use of the word Democrat instead of Democratic, which I think drives you up the wall.
It does. It makes me absolutely crazy.
Well, Tony Snow was asked about it in this morning's gaggle.
Really? By you?
No, not by me. By Mark Zola of CBS Radio.
Oh, interesting. And what happened? What did he say?
Well, he was asked about the president's reference to the Democrat-controlled Congress in the State of the Union address rather than the Democratic-controlled Congress.
Right.
I'll read you my notes. It was pointed out that by the press that some Democrats are bothered by this and they wondered if there was any pejorative intent. Snow thanked the press for making three mounds out of a molehill. He said the president did not mean anything by it. It was interesting. He said that the president made a speech with a gesture towards Nancy Pelosi, talking about reaching out and working together, and a few people who did not get the message ran out and complained that the letters IC were missing from Democrat. It was pointed out by another reporter that the week ahead, which is a schedule that they put out last week, also left IC off Democratic. It was pointed out that the nomenclature began 30 years ago as a slur against Democrats. Snow was asked if it was appropriate. Snow said he would not get into it. He said to look at every characterization of the president and ask the question to people who have used it against him. This president has tried to stay away from the business of doing slurs, and there was none intended.
Yeah.
Snow was asked if the president would refer to the party as Democratic in the future. He did not reply. He was asked if the president was unaware that he consistently refers to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party. Snow said he does not think anything of it. It was not deliberate.
Yeah, right. And we need to start calling it the Republican Party.
Republican Party.
Yeah, Republicans. I mean, you know, for in British English, it's a barkeeper, and in old English, it's a tax collector. It's not really a slur, but it's not. You know, Democrat isn't really a slur. It's just not democratic. So
exactly.
let's just call them the Republican Party.
Yeah, I like
that. And see how they like it, you know.
I like that.
Yeah. Actually, you know, if you've got enough of these publicans around, you do need a publican. You need a bartender, pretty short order. What else is happening in Washington, D.C. today?
I asked him what was the president's response to seeing the White House portrayed as being at war with itself in the Lilly trial. And not surprisingly, he wouldn't answer me.
Really?
Yeah,
he just plain old flat out wouldn't answer you?
Well, he won't comment on it. I asked him how closely the president's following the trial, and he indicated that he wasn't terribly interested in it. I said, really, Karl Rove and Dan Bartlett are under subpoena, and you've got whoever it is testifying.
Yeah.
Cheney testifying, and you're actually telling me that there's really no interest in this thing? Then I asked him, are you glad you weren't press secretary then? And he wouldn't answer me.
Amazing. Well, you know, Victoria, the world is in flames right now. I mean, we have an ecological disaster of biblical proportions right on our doorstep. We have a war in the Middle East, an ongoing occupation of Iraq that threatens to turn into World War III. Our invasion of Iraq could be the Archduke Ferdinand moment. It's increasingly looking like it. At the very least, we have a civil war going on in Iraq. People are dying literally every day, hundreds of people. Their lives are being made hellish as a consequence of the decisions that George Bush made. And he doesn't much care about any of that either. I have a feeling that he doesn't much pay attention to anything except whether or not he could ride his mountain bike or clear brush.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry. I am just
you're in a state.
Yeah, I am. I really am. Human lives are at risk here, and Bush just, you know. Yeah. So anyhow, Victoria, let's take a few phone calls here while you're on the line with me, if that's all right with you.
I'd love to.
Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Well, this is continuing with what you just said a few minutes ago about the Native Americans and tradition and such.
Mm-hmm.
And I've long lamented that we just lack tradition, and we have no ceremonies or anything in our culture anymore. Well, it's like what Gandhi said about Western culture would be a good idea.
Yeah, that's my point. It was stripped out in what Daniel Quinn refers to as the Great Forgetting. And as a consequence, we've latched on to pseudo-traditions like consumerism and militarism.
And at the same time, what we're doing here
and nationalism
is we're trying to destroy the traditions of people who are coming to this country.
Yes.
And
of immigrants.
Same thing
with destruction. Yeah, absolutely. In my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, the metaphor I used was that our melting pot is really the iron fist within the velvet glove of a dominator culture, of a culture that thinks it's better than all other cultures. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Jeff, for your comment. Victoria, you came from England. What's the take in Great Britain about American culture?
Well, there isn't any. I mean,
there isn't any take, or the take is that there isn't any culture here.
There is a take that there isn't any culture. I mean, you know, that it's baseball and basketball and 4th of July.
Yeah, and that in and of itself is not culture.
And you know, right, and that's basically as deep as it goes. But it's not necessarily America's fault, simply because it hasn't been around, and it takes time and substance to have culture.
Yeah. But don't the Brits look at Stonehenge and scratch their heads and wonder, hey, what happened?
Absolutely.
What happened to our culture?
Well,
you know?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we were indigenous people once, too. You know, all of us.
Yeah.
Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks for being with us
today.
Thank you. Always great talking with you. And thank you for listening to the program. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating conservative Dan Gaynor on, is it a good economy or not? And conservative Stephen Gabriel and I are going to shake it up with a question. A Canadian court has decided a child can have three parents. Is this good for kids? That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group up by it for We the People. And remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.